VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
The latest technology has always allowed medical professionals to provide their patients with the best medical care possible. Aspects of today's technology advancements, such as digital and information technology, robotics, genetic and bioengineering, nanotechnology, and artificial intelligence, give patients better and more accurate diagnosis, cutting-edge treatments, a host of procedures that result in minimal pain and quicker healing. On today's Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we will examine modern technology's impact on medicine and healthcare both today and tomorrow. My first guest is Dr. Bertalan Meshko, MD and PhD. He describes himself as a medical futurist. Dr. Meshko is the director of the Medical Futurist Institute, which analyzes how science fiction technologies can become a reality in medicine and healthcare. He is also a best-selling author and is one of the world's top experts on healthcare technology. Dr. Meshko, you refer to yourself and have a website called The Medical Futurist. What is a medical futurist?
Well, a medical futurist has a clear mission in mind. We want to prove to people that using good technologies can make patients the point of care. And for this, we have to be able to communicate clearly about the advantages and the potential issues around the use of digital health technologies to patients, physicians, or even governments. And that's what we do on the Medical Futurist channel. Channels, while in the background at the Medical Futurist Institute, we do the same, but in peer-reviewed research.
I'm curious, in reading on your website, you refer to yourself as a geek doctor. What is this all about?
Well, I'm a proud geek, not just a simple geek. No, I cherish technologies, and I've lived my life with technologies. I use a lot of technologies even in my work and improving my lifestyle. So by saying that I'm a geek physician, I want to imply that my background is not just being a medical doctor and being a researcher, but also being a geek. Because in this whole revolution we call digital health, what matters more is what kind of connections we build with each other, how we focus on the human touch, what kind of relationship we build with technologies, and not what actual technology comes out next.
Doctor, in looking at your website, The Medical Futurist, I saw a story that really caught my imagination. From human to cyborg, are you willing to augment your body? Now, the first thing that ran through my mind when I saw that was a classic television show that was popular in this country back about 30, 40 years ago called The $6 Million Man. And,
yes.
And there was a sequel called The Bionic Woman, where basically they're doing what you suggest. What would be augmented according to your thoughts, and what would be involved in the procedure?
The reason why we have to talk about such issues is that when you refer, when you use the term cyborg, for example, many people immediately think about science fiction movies like Terminator and really fearful, stressful scenarios where everything goes berserk. But being a cyborg doesn't mean we have to go that far in the future. Even having a pacemaker, theoretically or by definition, could mean that someone is a cyborg. Using your smartphone, which is a cognitive enhancement of your life, can also be referred to as becoming or going through cyborgization. So for me, augmentation means that it's all right to use advanced technologies to get something meaningful out of that relationship that we build with those technologies. If I can work better as a physician by using artificial intelligence algorithms, I should learn how to work with them rather than being afraid of losing my job because of being replaced by them. So that's the kind of issue we have here, that it's not technology versus people, it's technology and people. But by talking about cyborgization, we might initiate conversations where patients and physicians, you know, learn more about what it means to be augmented and why it's not a bad thing per se, but it's more like a chance for them to improve their own capabilities.
As the logo for the $6 Million Man and Bionic Woman, they mentioned that we can build them faster and make them stronger and basically give them superhuman powers. Do you see something like this in the future?
Not just the future. There is a sheep factory in South Korea where some workers, when they go into work every morning, they have to put on an exoskeleton, a robotic structure, and they can lift huge weights by being, you know, their muscles being augmented or supported by these robotic structures. For them, becoming Iron Man is basically part of their job. So this process has been going on, but there are only sporadic examples where becoming superhumans, you know, is part of someone's life or job.
One of the things about medical technology today and in the future is allowing patients a little more control, patient empowerment. Tell us how technology works into making the patient more responsible for his or her health care.
Absolutely. You know, people are more excited about topics such as becoming cyborgs and artificial intelligence, but patient empowerment is simply the most important milestone in the history of medicine. Since Hippocrates, for 2,000 years, everything in medicine has only worked within the ivory tower of medicine. You know, medical professionals could access studies, data, technologies, and experience, but nobody else outside the tower had that access. What's changing, though, in the 21st century is that because of social media, crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, and the access to new technologies through the internet, patients started becoming empowered. They wanted to get access to their own data because it first belongs to them, and second, many of them have paid for them. And patients want to be engaged in their care because, obviously, it's about their well-being. It's about their disease management. Even though it sounds like a new issue, it's ridiculous that we had to wait until the 21st century to involve the most important stakeholder in healthcare, patients, in their own health or disease management. So basically, it's about letting patients support the process of medicine, letting patients contribute with their data, with their experience, with their knowledge, because they do have a lot of these. And on an equal level partnership now, caregivers, medical professionals, and patients could work as partners. All of them or each of them bringing their own expertise, their own unique knowledge, but working as a big medical team around a health or medical issue. That's patient empowerment.
Dr. Meshko, I remember like maybe 5-10 years ago doing a program with a scientist. This was at the time that they were mapping the human genome. And one of the issues that we brought up was making it possible for individualized medicine. So we're looking at not only the role of genetic manipulation, modification, but we're also looking at stem cells, etc. Tell us about that.
I feel lucky because when I went to medical school and wanted to become a researcher in genetics, you know, I witnessed everything, all the milestones that happened in this process we call human genomics and how it's evolved since then. And when I first heard about genome sequencing, the cost was about $3 billion per person. I remember when I first wanted to have my genome sequenced, you know, just finishing medical school, it was about a few tens of thousands of dollars. And now I had my whole genome sequencing service for about $150 or so. And this experience of seeing my own DNA data and then seeing what a huge data set it is, and I'm just not enough even as a medical doctor to analyze that. So I had to reach out to a genetic counselor. I had to bring my data and the reports to my general practitioner so we all could discuss what kind of meaningful clinical consequences my data would have for my life. So now I have a prevention plan that we built with my GP, and we know what major medical conditions I have a risk for, so I can take some precautions. I can be cautious about trying to prevent them from happening. I know which medications would cause me side effects for 100% accuracy. It's good to know. For example, if I had to take a cholesterol-lowering medication, my chance for muscle tissue, heart muscle inflammation is about 95%. So it's better not taking them and try to find a different way for lowering cholesterol. I learned that there are some strange effects of DNA sequencing in your life, but the things I learned about myself, I think, gave me such an important chance for trying to prevent diseases from happening or from taking shape or catching them as early as possible because simply I have information about them. But I have to emphasize that without my partner in this, without my GP, who is trained to be able to analyze such data sets, or she was ready to say, I don't know, but let's find out together when we, you know, came across a challenge. Without her, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even get a clinical consequence of having my DNA sequence. So again, it's about the whole medical team. But without data, it's physically impossible to get even a chance for personalized care.
The way you describe it, doctor, is that it gave you a good idea of who you were genetically. What about the research that's going on to sort of manipulate the genes? In other words, if you had a gene that gave you a predisposition to cancer, that you can modify that gene so that you wouldn't get cancer, or you had some other deformities or problems along the way where the genes, again, could be manipulated to prevent those problems from happening.
Absolutely. There's a technique called CRISPR, which is basically a genome editing technique that we could do this before, but with this technology, it has become much simpler and much cheaper to do it, to edit the genome. The point is, as even having a whole genome, you know, sequencing service, we can't even analyze all the data points in my DNA code. We can't expect to see all the potential consequences of genome editing at that scale. Even though CRISPR has been the spotlight of genomics research for years now, we still don't see what would happen to someone who would go through CRISPR editing. We know about the Chinese twins. Researchers use CRISPR technique to remove certain parts of their genes, so then it would be impossible for them to become infected by HIV. Well, it might be a medical, clinical, positive outcome or advantage for them, but they have zero idea what might happen to them because of that technology later in their lives. We risk so many things here. And in medicine, when we make a medical decision, we always have to look at the risk-benefit ratio. And if the risks are just too high, then it doesn't make sense to use the technology until we have enough evidence for that. In the case of CRISPR, for medical, clinical, human use, we don't have that much evidence yet.
People in the Western world mostly in the Western world, love their technology gadgets. And among the more popular gadgets these days is something called a Fitbit and also an Apple smartwatch that monitors certain aspects of your health. Tell us about the use of wearable medical technology.
I'm not objective here because I've been quantifying my health for 15 years. I have a Fitbit, I have sleep trackers. The point I would like to make here is not that just purely using a wearable would lead to any better chance for a healthier lifestyle. I think that's usually not the case because people stop using their device after about 6 months or so because they don't see the motivation for keeping on using that. But one thing that might help people understand why it could be beneficial for them to get data about their lives is sleep tracking. It's not just that I learned what kind of sleep quality I have and how I can improve that with a few adjustments in my lifestyle, but the smart sleep alarm literally changed my life. What happens is before going to sleep every evening, I try to give a period of time, like waking up between 6 and 6:20 a.m. to my tracker. It tracks my sleep live, and within that time period in the morning, it wakes me up with one gentle vibration on my arm when I'm in light sleep. And when I tell you what it means to wake up in deep sleep, I'm sure you will know what I'm talking about here. When you wake up and you hate the world and you need, 5 cups of coffee to just wake up, that's waking up in deep sleep. But waking up in light sleep is just you feeling refreshed, energized for the whole day. The point is, between the two states, there might only be 2 minutes, but you cannot tell because you are asleep. But my sleep tracker can. So 9 out of 10 times, I wake up at the best slot in the morning, so I feel fresh, energized, just because I woke up from light sleep. This one thing, I'm sure, can shape a lifestyle for so many out there.
Looking at your website again, I came across this quote that I found fascinating, and I'd like you to explain it if you can. You raised a point about concerning health care as a choice rather than a chance as it is today. Can you explain by that chance and choice?
Yes, it's quite a controversial topic because when I tell people that based on the research we've been doing at the Medical Futures Institute, it turns out that because of many issues from the access to care to misdiagnosis and medical errors and so many other things out there, we think that luck plays a bigger role in your healthcare today than your decisions or decisions of your caregivers. And we can only change that through the use of advanced digital health technologies. So I'm not saying that everyone should use digital health technologies. I'm just saying that those who would love to use them or those who would love their medical professionals to use advanced technologies should have a chance for that because right now they don't have that chance. For this reason, I have to live like someone would live 10 years from now. I have to be the patient of the future. Mm-hmm. I have to show to people that using my DNA sequencing data, using my reports and data from sleep trackers and fitness wearables and all these that I can bring to my GP, to my caregiver, having a partnership with her, we can actually set up a prevention plan. We can try to prevent diseases from happening, and not just by waiting for a symptom to happen and maybe then catch something as early as possible, but preparing for that, showing those symptoms I should keep in mind so then we can really catch things as early as possible. So this notion, this chance that digital health technologies bring to us, I think might make this shift from decisions playing a bigger role in our lives and in our health or disease management than just pure luck.
Dr. Bertalan Meshko, I want to thank you so much for taking time to join us today and sharing your insights into the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was medical futurist Dr. Bertalan Meshko, MD and PhD. Dr. Meshko is director of the Medical Futurist Institute based in Budapest, Hungary, a best-selling author and one of the world's top experts in healthcare technology. Let's take a break now. This is the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, or from iTunes. We hope you'll get in touch with us either through Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or by sending us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. And now back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Today we're examining modern technology's impact on medicine and healthcare both today and tomorrow. In this segment, we will talk about the current and future use of artificial intelligence, or AI, in healthcare. My guest is Dr. Kaveh Safavi, MD, JD. He is the Senior Managing Director for Global Healthcare Business at Accenture. Accenture is a company that provides management consulting and professional services worldwide. Many of us have heard the term artificial intelligence or AI for a number of years. Yet I and perhaps a number of our listeners still don't know what AI really is. I know it's a broad umbrella term that encompasses many different things. Dr. Safavi, can you define AI for us?
I think about artificial intelligence as a new kind of information technology that actually allows the computer to learn for itself and to change its own programming without needing human intervention. That's really the big step function difference, is this idea that software and computers have the ability to learn without a human making a change. There are many kinds of specific technologies that computer scientists include in the category of AI, but that feature is what really defines this breakthrough.
I know that AI is being employed in many different areas of business right now, but I'm curious about the use of AI in healthcare medicine community. Is it currently in use, and if so, how?
Well, we're in the early stages, but it is really profound in terms of thinking about the possibilities. And the way to think about it is that we have thought about digital technology as a way to make our lives better through a number of different paths. We've thought about it as a way to take tasks over for human beings and automate them. And so that gives us the capacity to either produce more or reach more people. Healthcare in particular is struggling with the fact that the demand for services is growing faster than our ability to provide, to essentially educate enough clinical people to do the work. So if we continue down the course we're on, the World Health Organization has estimated that by 2030 we would have a 15 million person shortage of healthcare workers. And in rich countries but have low birth rates, like Japan and in the Nordics, for example, they're already running out of healthcare workers. And some estimates are that in some of these countries, if you look out 50 years, if we don't change anything, everyone in the workforce would have to work in healthcare. So we know it's not possible to do it that way. The other issue that is emerging is that healthcare costs grow faster than every industrialized economy, no matter how they organize or pay for healthcare, because they're labor or people-based parts of our economy, and the wages will keep growing, and you can't tax fast enough to compensate for the wages plus scientific innovation and an aging population. So we have a lot of reasons why we need to figure out how to move work from people to machines. However, healthcare is complicated, and while simple automation has worked for moving routine tasks from people to machines, in the last 30 years in the United States, most of the job expansion has been in non-routine tasks because routine tasks have already been automated. Healthcare has a significant amount of non-routine activities. And so therefore, it wasn't really until artificial intelligence was available as a technology that we had any hope of beginning to substitute technology for people and therefore start to close the gap between supply and demand or solve for this cost problem.
Doctor, digital health is yet another buzz phrase I've been hearing lately. Can you explain this and how is it different from AI?
I think the best way to think about it is artificial intelligence is a form of modern technology that's often included in the conversation about digital health. Most people would say that information technology, things like the internet, began to have an impact on society, obviously, 30, 40 years ago. We started using the word digital in the last 4 or 5 years to describe a specific set of newer kinds of information technology. Technology that was available mobile, so in your hand, technology that was social, technology that took advantage of some advances in the way we could store or compute things, so cloud storage, et cetera. And this new category emerged, which is technology that can learn. And while many people would include that as a form of digital technology, when people use the word AI, they're really talking about a subclass of digital technology that can learn for itself without necessarily requiring human intervention. And that gives us a big step function forward in terms of what's possible.
Back to AI again, and from what I've been seeing online, are the current emphasis on digital health and AI mostly looking and mostly concerned about the administrative aspects of healthcare, like running hospitals or medical practices, billing, record keeping, and so forth? How do you see this technology actually playing a part of making and keeping people healthy?
Well, interestingly enough, if you just looked at the newspapers as a way to try to understand what's going on with how artificial intelligence will affect healthcare, most of the stories focus on the technology helping doctors make better decisions. So, for example, helping a doctor identify the best possible treatment for cancer, because cancer is a complicated area, and it's getting to the point now where we think that every person's treatment recommendation will be different than another person's. It's almost impossible for a doctor to know what to do without the help of technologies that can make lots of computations and find a lot of information. And so we saw a lot of those stories. However, if you think about all of the work that has to be done in healthcare, what you realize is that there's a lot of work that goes on that doesn't really require the ability of a doctor to diagnose or treat, but does require judgment in decisions that include everything from how do I make an appointment to how does this insurance work, how does this bill get paid, all the way to am I eligible for other social programs? A whole bunch of things happen. And what we are seeing is that the opportunity for artificial intelligence to have an impact on healthcare is probably going to come first in areas that are not about clinical judgment, because it's easier to make sure that you're doing the right thing. It doesn't take as much effort to prove that you're making a mistake, and the risks aren't as high, quite frankly. So the opportunities are big and the barriers are lower. So we actually think that the first wave of widespread adoption will be in non-clinical or business functions. And then as we get better at validating that the technology is safe and you can rely on it for decisions to diagnose or treat, then you'll begin to see more widespread use of it in these kinds of clinical functions. And we're already beginning to see artificial intelligence show up in healthcare, probably not obvious to a patient, but there are places where it's showing up, for example, behind the scenes. If you call an organization, an insurance company or a government for help with your healthcare benefits, in many cases, there's an artificial intelligence technology that's either answering the call or helping the person answering the call to make a better decision for you. Or you're seeing it behind the scenes in the ability to read documents and to find information that used to be read by human beings, but the machine can read the document and find the words and the terms and prepare them or put them into the computer or some way make it available. You're also seeing it used in analytics that our healthcare providers like hospitals are using to figure out who the sickest patients are, or drug companies are using to aim their drug discovery at patients that really need it. So it's there. It's not necessarily what patients see, but it's really starting to have an impact already behind it.
Well, when I think about AI, digital technology in healthcare, I'm picturing its use in diagnostics. For example, when you take an MRI, an X-ray, a CAT scan, whatever kind of photograph you take of the patient to diagnose a condition or a disease, that I can see AI being able to fill the void between the doctor and what the doctor is actually seeing in the scan.
That's one of the uses that has gotten a lot of notoriety. And what's happening there is that you are trying to improve the quality of the doctor's judgment in looking at pictures, partly because, frankly, humans make decisions. We have certain biases in our judgment that the machine doesn't make, and that's a good thing. However, the goal or the expectation is not that the technology fully replaces the doctor. It's much more that the technology looks at the image and is able to quickly find all of the relevant abnormalities, categorize them, compare them to previously seen abnormalities, so that when the radiologist, for example, looks at an image, they're not just looking at an image. They're looking at an image that's already been evaluated by technology and all the hotspots have been identified. Because artificial intelligence, for the most part, is not designed to make decisions. It's designed to improve predictions by putting probabilities around things. It's still ultimately the task of a human to make the single judgment when they look at a picture like that.
When you're talking about digital healthcare, one thing that comes to mind is telemedicine. As you mentioned earlier, healthcare costs are rising all over the world, and to be more efficient and to give people who really don't have access to healthcare, the use of telemedicine has become popular. What is telemedicine? How's it employed, and where is it employed?
Telemedicine is a great example of using information technology, digital technologies broadly, to scale our healthcare system's capacity to reach people where either physical distance is a problem or you need to substitute for a person because the doctor's not available. So, for example, a patient that has access to a device might allow that patient to understand and navigate the doctor's recommendations or the symptoms without having to talk back to someone at the doctor's office, as an example. Digital healthcare, telemedicine, and virtual healthcare, which has been sort of the way people broaden it, have existed prior to artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence just makes the technology smarter, and therefore it increases our ability to use self-service as one of the ways to expand the reach of the healthcare system. So, for example, we're starting to see a number of companies that used to be in the business of providing, let's say, a nurse or a healthcare coach to help somebody with a chronic illness. So the diagnosis and treatment occurs by a doctor in the traditional way. This happens for many patients. But once they're out of the office, there's a lot of conversations about, should I be eating this? I'm not feeling the right way. Should I worry about it? Many of those conversations were historically conducted with someone in the clinical staff, but not the doctor. Many times there was even an outreach call to say, by a nurse, to say, hey, how are you doing? Some percentage of that can actually be now executed by essentially a virtual character, an image of a doctor or a nurse that's computer generated, and actually can have a conversation with you where it understands what you're saying and it responds even to your emotions, because artificial intelligence makes it smart. So it's not running through a simple script. It's actually interacting with you. And its ability to interact is because artificial intelligence has made that experience interactive. The science and the medicine is the same science and medicine that always existed. But now you can reach more people without necessarily having to have clinical people matching up one-to-one. And for some conditions, we've actually identified the fact that people would rather interact with technology than a human because they feel stigmatized when they talk to a human. We see this in mental health. More people will seek mental health services if they can do it anonymously and not interact with a human. Same thing with people who are checking in to see if they're following their diet, for example, or their medications. They might feel a stigma around admitting to a person who calls that they're not following their diet, but less of a stigma when they interact with the technology. So we see some really interesting benefits, not just efficiency, but maybe even better outcomes because of it.
Doctor, is the matter of trust, patient trust, how do you see this technology working with people?
The issue of trust is interesting and complicated because there's a trust problem, or could be a trust problem, whether you interact with a machine or whether you interact with a human being. So as it relates to technology like artificial intelligence, we've talked about a concept called explainable artificial intelligence as being critical to adoption. And this is true in healthcare and outside of healthcare. And basically what we're seeing is humans who rely on technology to get their work done or to answer a question or to solve a problem, they need to understand, the technology needs to be explainable. They need to understand what the assumptions were, because if they can't trust the technology, they're not going to use it. So concepts of explainable artificial intelligence and responsible artificial intelligence have actually become part of the narrative around artificial intelligence.
Dr. Kaveh Safavi, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today and for sharing your insights.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
That was Dr. Kaveh Safavi, MD, JD, Senior Managing Director for Global Healthcare Business at Accenture, a worldwide management consulting and professional services provider. And I am afraid that's all the time we have for this Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Thanks to both of my guests in today's program, as well as Ben Dieter, an assistant producer at VOA's Current Affairs Unit, for his help. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castillo next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.